do beg your indulgence on sitting as close to the phone as possible. I'm just aware, I felt like I was shouting last week, and I know my voice is not the strongest in the world, and also I feel more comfortable when people are more or less in a circle. It's much more congenial environment for me as a teacher. I've neglected to mention one thing in the course, and it was called to my attention by a student today. It is in the course description, and that is obviously that the course requirements do include the writing of a paper at some point in the course. Obviously, this is a two-semester course, so you've got a lot of time to do that. And I, as any of you who have been with me before, know that there's no absolute deadline for me in terms of when papers are handed in. If it's beyond the end of the course and you want to take a standing deferred, if you're an AD student, there's no problem. If you're a basic degree student, we can work that out. Can be arranged. So you don't have to give it in by the end of the course if you don't want to. The paper does not have to be a research paper where you start reading a lot of other books. You can focus, you can quote one book, and this one mainly, and that's quite adequate as far as I'm concerned for this particular course. It's like in the theology department, they said once that, for the major comprehensive paper, they expect a bibliography of at least 8 books. And I, at the theology department meeting, I said, well, suppose somebody is working on process thought, and one of the books is Whitehead's Process and Reality, which is about as big as Insight. Are you going to demand that that person read 7 other books? That's crazy. You know? So the same thing here. This is a big enough task, as I'm sure you're finding out. And for the paper, you can take one central problem, the notion of judgment, the notion of objectivity, hermeneutics, in Insight. That's it. Okay? But I've got to have something in writing that I can evaluate to help me evaluate your work in the course. So it's by the end of the course or even beyond if that suits your schedule. I was also asked about a glossary of Lonergan terms, and there is one that is available, and the best way to get a hold of it is through the internet. If you go to, you take the following steps on the internet. That will put you, that's the web page of the Lonergan Research Institute. And then you go to related sites, and under related sites, you go to the Lonergan website, and the Lonergan website is the website run by a group of people who began the Lonergan website in Ottawa. And among the various things that are available on the Lonergan website is a glossary of Lonergan terminology, mainly done by Carla May Streeter, former student at Regis College, did her doctorate in the 80s or in the 80s, yes. She's constantly adding new terms and new explanations of terms to the glossary. That website also contains the Lonergan Studies newsletter, which we do most of the work on at the Lonergan Research Institute, but they've got a much more powerful engine for publishing things on the internet than we do. So we send the Lonergan Studies newsletter off to them. That's a quarterly newsletter updating people on various articles and books and so on that are on Lonergan or that use Lonergan or that are related to the discussions that are going on in the Lonergan community. So that website is worth your attention. Okay, and then one other question that has arisen from 2 students in the course of the last week. Can I say a little bit more about the relationship between insight and concept? So let me do that before we try to move into chapter 2 today. There's a couple of things that I brought along that will be helphful here. I was just reading Noam Chomsky last night, Education, Democracy, and Education. And as you probably know, Chomsky has a theory of universal grammar and universal linguistic structures. That is a very provocative and very controversial theory. It makes a lot of sense to a lot of people that we are wired for language, and that that wiring is universal, and that there are, for all of the differences, there are profound affinities in the various linguistic structures of different peoples. He's also a social, radical social thinker, at least as far as in the United States is concerned. He's extremely critical of American policy around the world. So he's got two hats. He's this intellectual, and he's also a quite radical social activist. The question that was raised to him, do we think only in language, or do there exist non-linguistic forms of thinking too? And his answer is the following. The analysis of linguistic structures could help in understanding other intellectual structures. Now, I don't think that there is any scientific evidence about the question whether we think only in language or not. But introspection indicates pretty clearly that we don't think in language necessarily. We also think in terms of visual images. We think in terms of situations and events and so on. And many times we can't even begin to express in words what the content of our thinking is. And even if we are able to express it in words, it is a common experience to say something and then to recognize that it's not quite what we meant, that it's something else, and we're still moving towards the accurate articulation. What does this mean? That there is a kind of non-linguistic thought going on which we then are trying to represent in language, and that we know that sometimes we fail to represent it in language. Now, I think what he's trying to get at there, or in Lonergan terminology, it would be that there is a preconceptual event named insight, or the act of understanding, which gives rise immediately to some kind of inner word, all right, which then we attempt to formulate in the outer word. But our formulation is constantly catching up with the fullness of the insight itself. And a lot of times we're struggling to give adequate articulation to the insight. And that's exactly what I think Chomsky is trying to get at this point. We also think in terms of visual images. Well, Lonergan would say, yes, but we have insight into images, and they don't necessarily have to be visual. We think in terms of situations and events, and many times can't even begin to express in words what the content of our thinking is. There's that struggle for the accurate articulation of it. And that's the kind of relationship that Lonergan is talking about between insight and concept, and then concept, inner word, and outer word. On the other hand, in Method and Theology, pages 254 and 255, he deals with the objection that comes from the philosophy of Ludwig Wittgenstein with regard to language and understanding, language and meaning. The Wittgensteinian position is the following, that since the publication of Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations, there has been a growing consensus that the meaningfulness of language is essentially public and only private. Unless this were so, language couldn't serve as a vehicle for intersubjective communication. The meaning of a term, accordingly, is explained chiefly by clarifying its use or the family of usages associated with it. This requires an analysis both of the way terms function within language, or a study of syntax, and also of the extra-linguistic contexts in which its use is appropriate, or questions of semantics and pragmatics. A consequence of this position is that the meaning of a word is not explicable by reference or reduction to private mental acts. Now, Lonergan, that's the Wittgensteinian position, and here's what Lonergan says. I find this a clear and helpful basis of discussion. I wish to clarify my own position by adding a few remarks. First, I do not believe, though in agreement with the Wittgensteinian position, I do not believe that mental acts occur without a sustaining flow of expression. The expression may not be linguistic, it may not be adequate, it may not be presented to the attention of others, but it occurs. Secondly, I have no doubt that the ordinary meaningful, and this is a very important distinction that he makes more clearly in this passage than anywhere else, page 255 in Method of Theology. I have no doubt that the ordinary meaningfulness of ordinary language is essentially public and only derivatively private. For language is ordinary if it is in common use. It is in common use not because some isolated individual happens to have decided what it is to mean, but because all the individuals of the relevant group understand what it means. Similarly, it is by performing expressed mental acts that children and foreigners come to learn a language. But they learn the language by learning how it ordinarily is used, so that their private knowledge of ordinary usage is derived from the common usage that essentially is public. And that's granting the Wittgensteinian position. The ordinary meaningfulness of ordinary language is essentially public. And it comes to us then in a conceptual way. Thirdly, however, what is true of the ordinary meaningfulness of ordinary language is not true of the original meaningfulness of any language, ordinary, technical, or literary or technical. For all language develops, and at any time, any language consists in the sedimentation of the developments that have occurred and have not become obsolete. Now, developments consist in discovering new uses for existing words, in inventing new words, and in diffusing the discoveries and inventions. All three are a matter of expressed mental acts. And that's, so this is where insight is at the base of conceptualization and language. The discovery of a new usage is a mental act expressed by the new usage. The invention of a new word is a mental act expressed by the new word. The communication of the discoveries and inventions can be done technically by introducing definitions or spontaneously, as when A utters his new verbal constellation, B responds, A grasps in B's response how successful he was in communicating his meaning, and in the measure he failed, he seeks and tries out further discoveries and inventions. So, all right, so there's the difference then between ordinary meaningfulness and original meaningfulness. In ordinary meaningfulness, the language that we use to communicate with one another, there is a certain priority of conceptualization and language to insight. But what Lonergan's talking about here, when he talks about insight at the root of conceptualization, he's talking about new insights giving rise to new concepts and new verbal usages and so on. He's talking about original meaningfulness. That's the primary emphasis in his work, is original meaningfulness. The primary emphasis in Wittgenstein is ordinary meaningfulness. Lonergan finds a complementarity between the two. He's saying, I'll grant everything Wittgenstein is saying as long as he doesn't make it exclusive. And he's not claiming an exclusivity for his own relationship between insight and concept and language. Does that help with regard to any of these questions on the relationship between insight and concept that some people at least have asked me to clarify a little bit further? Is there anything more that Mike said about that? Cora.
Can I ask, is the distinction that you just made something then to line up with imminently generated knowledge and received knowledge?
That's one of the very definite applications of that, yeah. Okay. The paper that I did last summer in Boston, Reception and Elemental Meaning, draws heavily on this distinction, and it relates longer than not only to Wittgenstein but also to Heidegger, using this distinction between original meaningfulness and ordinary meaningfulness. And that one of the applications that I make of it is the distinction between imminently generated knowledge and whatever is received, whether it's received from your cultural tradition or from your religious tradition or whatever. But see, even then, we all reach a point where we've got to subject all of that to an imminent critique, and then we end up making it our own. And it's only made our own once we've done that. We've called it into question, and respectfully, of course, yeah. And so on and so forth, but taken our own position. It's not ours until we do that. Yeah. And then, once we've done that, original meaningfulness is at work.
Okay. So it's not true to say received knowledge. It's data until... Is it?
That's right. That's the point that I'm making there. Okay. What counts as data
Yeah.
Is more than what you might get from a lot of what Lonergan says. I think that, that there's room in his work for it, but it's not simply colors and sounds and tastes and so on and so forth. It's also received meanings and values.
Mm.
They also come to us at an empirical level of consciousness. And that's what Heidegger and Wittgenstein are, each in his own way, are emphasizing, and they must be paid attention to. That's very important. I saw last night Random House, no, not Random House, the National Review's list of the 100 most important nonfiction books of the 20th century. 57 is Wittgenstein's Tractatus, 58 is Lonergan's Insight, 59 is Heidegger's Being and Time. And I say, there's my paper from last night, those three. It was very interesting. And two of the people that, that Lonergan was very, very impressed with, Schumpeter, Joseph Schumpeter, the economist, is on the list, and Jane Jacobs, the urbanologist who was living here in Toronto, is two of her books are on the list. She's the only one. She's the only one who got two books on the list.
What was the top book?
Winston Churchill's History of the Second World War. It's a very interesting list. It's really quite interesting. But I was happy to see Lonergan make it onto it. Okay, are we ready then to move on to chapter two? All right, so the heuristic structures of the empirical method. In terms of what I've got here, you can break it down into the following. Numbers 1 to 7 on my list here constitute a unit that they deal with sections 1 and 2, sections 1 and 2 of the chapter. And then next, numbers 8 to 16 deal with section 3 of the chapter. And the main point in section 3 is, the main point to grasp is the relationship between, or the difference between systematic and non-systematic process. And then, so that's 8 to 16, and then number 17 to 20 deal with section 4 on statistical heuristic structures. So that's the way these can be broken down. I neglected to put in sections 3 and 4 explicitly where they begin, anyway, that's the way, that's the breakdown of the material here. So the point in chapter 2 is to make a first move toward capturing the dynamism, the essential dynamism of human intelligence. As he says at the very beginning, the terms that were implicitly defined in relationship to one another in chapter 1, image, insight, concept, particularly those three terms, that still remains rather static. And we've got to put it in motion. We have to set it in motion. And one of the areas where we can definitely see it very much in motion is in scientific process, the procedures of empirical method in modern science. It's an interesting statement here that I read in Chomsky last night, by the way, and this is just something to reflect on. I don't think we can go into it too much, but there, so far, he says, there is in fact one area only in which we have demonstrated the capacity for true scientific progress, namely physics and those parts of other fields that grow out of physics, chemistry and so on and so forth. But in terms of human behavior, we haven't gotten very far. In Chomsky's Chomsky on Democracy and Education, page 62. But anyway, that's what he's going into here, is the way in which, in science at least, we have demonstrated the capacity for true scientific progress. So he's appealing then to empirical natural science and its heuristic structures. The structures it uses to anticipate discovery. Heuristic, the word heuristic comes from the Greek word heurisko, I find, I discover. The word eureka is from that word heurisko. Eureka is actually the perfect of that I have discovered, I found it. Eureka, I've got it. So it's from the word heuristic. So heuristic structures are the structures that we employ as we anticipate and move towards the goal that we want, namely understanding knowledge. So we use structures to anticipate discovery and guide our inquiry toward it, and what he's doing in this chapter is showing two of the structures that we use. In the course of the book, he will discuss four heuristic structures, classical and statistical, as they are used in modern empirical science, genetic heuristic structure, that comes in chapter 15, on the study of development. So in the life sciences, in the study of human beings, in psychology and so on, what's employed is genetic method, and then dialectical method, which comes in chapter 17, dialectical heuristic structures to deal with conflict and contradiction. So he will outline four heuristic structures in this book: classical, statistical, genetic, dialectical. This chapter gives us the first two of those in their rudimentary form, classical and statistical. In method and theology, he goes on and gives us a couple of other heuristic structures, and particularly historical, for the work of the historian. What procedures does the historian follow to reach the historian's goal of determining what happened, what really was going forward? What's structures of anticipating that kind of discovery. Now, I mentioned here that if you want to find it, I think it's helpful to either look at Understanding and Being Lecture 3 or to listen to the MP3 of Understanding and Being for August the 6th, which corresponds to Lecture 3 in the book Understanding and Being. I found this very helpful even yesterday as I was making last-minute preparations for the class today to listen to the August 6th MP3, where Lonergan's talking precisely about this material. And you'll see in his own lectures what he regards as important. And what, if he's not talking about something, then it's not necessary for moving on in the book. And so that it can be rather consoling to see that there's a lot of this material that he just brushes over lightly when he's lecturing to an audience that's coming to the book for the first time. All right, so section one then, mathematical and scientific insights compared. The chapter starts by outlining similarities and dissimilarities of mathematical and scientific insights. The similarities with math are the following. In both cases, inquiry is restricted to immanent intelligibility. So you're not interested in, like with the wheel, you're not interested in, okay, why do we have wheels, or who made them, or what are they made out of, but rather, what's the immanent intelligibility of the roundness of it? Okay. In both cases, and in science, it's the immanent intelligibility of a free fall, like Galileo's experiments with the Tower of Pisa, or whatever it is. So you're not interested in the final material or efficient causes, to use scholastic categories there, but rather in the immanent intelligibility of itself. What characterizes a free fall? What is it? In both cases, inquiry starts from a supposition. For example, in science, that there's some correlation between the measurable aspects of falling bodies, the distance covered and the time squared. That's how Galileo started, that there's some correlation between the distance and the time. Now, what is it? So you start with some kind of supposition. That's the beginning of insight. That's the clue. Okay, and you push it, and you see whether it leads anywhere. Now, you can have suppositions. If they don't lead anywhere, then you've got to start all over again. Surmises in history, too, that don't lead you anywhere. Go back and begin again. And thirdly, the similarity that the products of scientific laws taken singly hold perfectly only in a vacuum. The law of falling bodies, the proportion between the distance and the time, the distance is proportional to the square of the time, really holds perfectly only in a vacuum. There will be other things interfering with it in any other environment. And that is, he says, is similar to moving into the realm of the non-imaginable in mathematics, that you get like a point and a line, which are non-imaginable concepts. The dissimilarities are that in science you need experimentation, not just images, to work with. In mathematics, no matter how sophisticated it gets, if it's pure mathematics, you're manipulating images, you're manipulating symbols. But in empirical science, you need to experiment with various objects, the way bodies actually do fall. You're not just working out how they could fall, what it might be, what the possible correlations could be. No, that's not what they're interested in. How do they? And the only way to find that out is to start dropping things and putting them on planes and so on and so forth. Secondly, the data are discontinuous. So whenever, as Galileo performed these, he would plot it on a distance time graph. You know, the time is this way, the distance is this way, and you've got these points. But the points are all discontinuous, and you never get a continuum of those points. The drawn curve represents a presumption. When you draw the curve through the points, you're presuming that this is what it is. There's never an infinity of measurements of distance and time, and there can't be. Thirdly, you're not grasping necessity and impossibility, precisely because of this reason, precisely because the data are continuous. What you're grasping is possibility, but you are not ruling out that some other law might really be more accurate. The insight is hypothetical, whereas at least with this definition of the circle, you're grasping necessity. It must be round if the distance from the center is equal all the way around. Fourthly, the data don't conform to thinking the way a mathematician's images do. They go their own way, they're refractory, they're intransigent, and that's what causes the need, that's what makes for the need for ever further experimentation. Fifthly, operations yielding higher viewpoints are not merely symbolic. Deductions and calculations involving mathematical symbols, for instance. Okay, you move to a higher viewpoint by subtracting and getting into, by the subtraction that brings you into negative numbers, but that's still a matter of manipulating symbols. Okay? But here, the operations are experimental, they're directed by a hypothesis, they're revealing hitherto neglected data. As you experiment, you find things that you didn't have before. So his summary of that, the circuit of mathematical development may be named immanent. It moves from images through insights and conceptions to the production of symbolic images whence higher insights arise, mathematically. But the circuit of scientific development includes action upon external things. You change the data as you experiment. Okay? That's the influence of the experimentation on the data. The circuit of scientific development includes action upon external things. It moves from observation and experiment to tabulations and graphs, from these to insights and formulations, from formulations to forecasts, from forecasts to operations in which it obtains fresh evidence, either to confirm or to revise the existing views. Okay. I think that's pretty straightforward. Are we okay with that? Next. Classical heuristic structures, and this is where the dynamic aspect comes to the fore. The process as brought to explicit structure is a heuristic structure. So when you make it explicit, okay, when the procedures of scientific method are made explicit, it becomes a heuristic structure. A heuristic, again, is a principle of discovery. So we all can remember from first year high school or whenever it was that you took algebra, the whole thing, let X be the unknown number. And then you work out, well, what are the various criteria that you've got to satisfy to come up with a value for X? And then you move towards that once you know what must be satisfied. That's a heuristic structure. By making explicit the fact that you're heading towards some unknown, you make things more precise. And then especially by saying what that unknown must be, what can you work out about it now? But sciences like physics and chemistry employ two sets of heuristic structures, classical and statistical. So to speak of a heuristic structure in classical science means that we can anticipate the unknown, name it, infer its properties and relations, grasp the possibility of combining these in a law, equation, correlation, and express the law or solve the equation. So that's how means can be ordered to an end when the end is knowledge and the knowledge is not yet acquired. This is a question that was asked, first of all, by Plato somewhere in the dialogue. You know, how is it possible that I can know when I've gotten to the answer when I don't know what it is that I'm heading towards? And yet when I get there, I know it. And I know that I know it. How is that possible? So how can means be ordered to an end when the end is still unknown? The end is knowledge, and the knowledge is not yet acquired. Well, what they do then, this is a very simple explanation, what they do what in the classical kind of physics that would be associated with the names of anywhere from Newton all the way down through Einstein, that is, you name the unknown, you infer what its properties and relations must be, you put together everything that you already know about what's got to be satisfied in order to get there, and then you proceed step by step, moving towards it, coming up with laws, equations, correlations, or whatever, and then you verify those, and then you've got it, okay? So that's how you order means to an end, and the end is knowledge, and the knowledge is not yet acquired. Okay, so Galileo's clue was there's got to be some correlation between the measurable aspects of distance and time. How did he come up with that? Where did that come from? The supposition of some correlation between the measurable aspects of falling bodies. Well, okay, in classical science, the desired unknown is first named something like the nature of something. What's the nature of a free fall? Okay, what is it? What's its, in the old scholastic terminology, it's quiddity, okay? A word that, you know, can drive people crazy because sometimes it was used so conceptualistically and so on. But what is it? It's the whatness of it, okay? This whatness, this nature, will be universal because similars are similarly understood. So once you've understood one, then anything that's similar to it will be understood in the same way, in exactly the same fashion. It's the same thing that we saw with the durable residue, okay? That it doesn't make any difference, merely numerical difference. If it's the same event, just different data, but the same thing happening, then understanding one is understanding another. So the similars are similarly understood, but you will understand, so that once you understand these data, then you will understand similar data in exactly the same fashion. Now here's Galileo's thing. This is where modern science begins, where modern science becomes differentiated from the Aristotelian science that held sway up to but really through the whole Middle Ages and into the Renaissance period. What do you mean by similar? And here, this is what Lonergan will later call the bifurcation of understanding. He doesn't use the terminology in insight. Similarities can be of two different kinds. There are the similarities of things to us. They're the same color, they're similar in color, they're similar in shape, they're similar in sound, and so on and so forth. And there are similarities of things in their relations to one another. Now the word things here is being used very broadly and generically. We'll pin it down later. And he's just using it in a way that's just very like res in Latin, okay? It can be used for all sorts of things. But it's the relations of whatever it is that you're studying to one another. Namely, that X and Y are always found together. Wherever you got X, you got Y. Or they're never found together. Where you've got X, there's no Y. And that's you discover, you see that, and you're trying to understand the relations of things to one another. They increase or decrease concomitantly. They have similar antecedents or consequence. They're similar in their proportions to one another, etc. Galileo's move was from things in their relations to us to things in their relations to one another. This is a move that Aristotle did not make as sharply and as clearly as began, at least on Lonergan's account, the movement of modern science in Galileo. The movement from, now Galileo, Lonergan will later criticize Galileo's distinction between secondary qualities and primary qualities, and say that, you know, he didn't quite get it right. But that's what he's talking about, is the movement from things in their relations to us to things in their relations to one another. And what science wants is to understand things in their relations to one another. That's his move. That's his that I don't get to the immanent intelligibility of something until I get to the relations of the measurable aspects to one another, the relations of distance and time, in this particular case, to each other. Sensible similarities are known before the nature of something has been discovered. They form the basis of preliminary classifications. It's the similarities of things in their relations to one another that are the proximate materials of insight into the nature of. The nature of is an unspecified correlation to be specified. So that the distance is proportional to the square of the time. That's the specification. Okay? But when I just say what's the nature of, I'm still, I know there's some correlation, or I'm suspecting there's some correlation, but it's as yet unspecified, and it's to be specified. An undetermined function to be determined. Modern science maintains, and Galileo really set it on this road, at least in this overview here, that one must proceed to relations that hold directly between things themselves, things understood here quite generically, so that it could include something like distance and time. It's the relation between those two, how they are related to one another, that gives him a scientific flaw. Science can that proceeds in this way can present us with a world that we find extremely odd and strange, because it can move away from the imagination. Eddington's book, he spoke about the two tables. Okay, this table that is brown and solid, and it's here, and if I want to sit on it, I can, and it will hold me, and so on and so forth. And then the scientific explanation of exactly the same table in terms of particles moving and it's two tables. And it's one table, but it's two explanations, and he spoke of it as the two tables. A world that we find extremely odd and strange, where the fundamental concepts are removed from immediate experience, and they're a set of correlations, okay? They're arrived at from correlating measurements. Mass and temperature are scientific concepts. This little piece of metal right here feels colder. No, it doesn't. It feels colder than this, but it's not. Okay. And temperature is not the how it feels. It's not the experience of hot and cold. It's something that's measured. But if you actually measured them, you would find that they were, I hope you would find them, that they were exactly the same temperature, even though one feels, because of the character of the material, it will feel colder under certain circumstances.
Excuse me, Paul.
So, yes?
Are you making reference to the person, the inventor, who just won $100,000 for developing a device that measures thermo something, something, something?
No, I wasn't. I didn't even know about that.
But just this morning there was a discussion on the CBC, and she used your example, except she was talking about an appliance, like a metal toaster, if you find one,
right.
and a cushion,
right.
And using that, and then the phone rang, so I didn't get. I didn't get to the really key thing that she's invented.
Common sense came in.
Yes.
Common sense interrupted
like
the world
that.
Entirely.
It was, because I was thinking of that example, because she was using the contrast of the relation of things to us, and then relation of things. But I suspect that her invention in being able to make that measure, is it going to involve the human sense in any capacity? And so therefore, can a human sensory capacity ever be regarded as a thing? Things related to things.
Oh, in the sense in which he's using the word thing at this point, yes. Now, he'll later come up with a much more technical notion of thing, where the answer would be no. That human capacity is a property of you. And you are the thing. Where a thing becomes a unity, identity, whole, and data. But at this point, he's using the word very generically.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and then is this the real world? Which of these is the real world? Well, that question will be answered later. And Lonergan's answer to it is contrary to a lot of modern science from and modern thought reliant on Galileo. He would say they're both the real world. It's just that they're under two different perspectives. True judgments can be made about things as they're related to us, and true judgments can be made about things as they're related to one another. And the real world is known whenever you make a true judgment. So if you know things and their relations to us, and you make true judgments about it, you know the real world. And if you know things and their relations to one another, and you make true judgments about it, you know the real world. So they're both the real world, but they're two different takes on the real world. Okay, number six then. Am I moving too fast? Okay, so up to this point. It gets more complicated as you go along, as you know, with Besides the movement upwards from the data towards the determination of the formulae, whatever they may be, and we take the distance, time, distance is proportional to time squared is a very simple formula. There's also a downward movement operative in the sciences. Later on in the book, he will use the metaphor of the scissors, the upper blade and the lower blade of the scissors. The lower blade is the assembly of the data, and the inquiry and the experimentation, so on and so forth, moving from below upwards. And the upper blade is the heuristic anticipation. And whatever it is that at any given point in history specifies that heuristic anticipation. The heuristic anticipation develops through time. So, for instance, at the present time, the idea that similars are similarly understood, that's part of your heuristic anticipation. It's part of your, if you want to use the traditional philosophic term, it's part of your a priori. Right? This is a posteriori, this is a priori. They both work together. Part of your a priori in science is similars are similarly understood. The idea that the relevant similarities are the similarities of things in their relations to one another, that fills in this heuristic anticipation. Now, it wasn't that clear before Galileo. So heuristic structures develop in history. Heuristic structures are not innate in their imminent internal determination, right? They develop through history. So the ideas pertain to that upward, to that downward movement from above, the movement from above, the heuristic anticipation. So similars are similarly understood. The relevant similarities are the similarities of things and their relations to one another. Modern science has added another element to that heuristic anticipation, namely the techniques of the calculus, and that the solution to many of the issues will be the solution to a particular differential equation. Okay, now, I'm not equipped to say much more than that about it, that Lonergan's just claiming that modern science has added the calculus to the heuristic anticipations with which scientists proceed. Okay. And when you go on into statistics there, he moves beyond the calculus into what are known as eigenfunctions and so on, and the calculus of probabilities. These are all new determinations that were arrived at a posteriori and then became part of the a priori. So that the ongoing movement of scientific development, we come to things a posteriori, like the calculus, for instance, but then once it's discovered, it becomes part of the upper blade in the scissors. Okay? That's, I have the scissors backwards, so it should be this way. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it doesn't matter, you get what I'm talking about. Modern science then also employs the techniques of the calculus to abstract from the non-countable infinity of the continuum and to arrive at its required functions by the use of differential equations. So the scientist says, let some indeterminate function f of x, y, z be the required function. The empirical inquirer then moves towards the determination of the indeterminate function by writing down differential equations that it must satisfy. This element works from above once it has been discovered, functioning as anticipations of the formulae that are to be discovered. The differential equation is an anticipation of the possible laws relevant to the formulation of what one is trying to understand. But this also indicates that heuristic structures emerge in history, right? And this is scientific development. It would be part of what Lonergan would say with respect to Kuhn on scientific revolutions, that part of his agreement. I was a little bit too glib in the first class with identifying his higher viewpoints with paradigm shifts, because there are some differences, but part of the agreement would be that scientific revolutions do occur, and part of it is that these, for Lonergan, would be that there are new elements that are added to the heuristic anticipations with which we move towards what we are coming to know. What he's trying to offer later on in the book is a notion of dialectic that will be to the human sciences what the differential equation is to the natural sciences. That the notion of dialectic will provide the main element in the upper grade for studying human behavior, and for studying human individuals, human societies, and human cultures. We'll see that. It's introduced at the end of chapter 7.
Could you repeat that again?
Yeah, the notion of dialectic will be introduced at the end of chapter 7. Well, it's introduced in chapters 6 and 7, but then the claim is made at the end of chapter 7. That the notion of dialectic can function as it becomes developed, right? And he's only offering the beginnings of the development. But as it becomes developed, it can be to the human sciences what the differential calculus is to the natural sciences. It can provide the principal element in the upper blade for studying human interrelations, human development, whether it's the development of individuals, the development of communities, cultural development, etc. So that to be equipped with this notion of dialectic is a powerful tool, if you want, for the understanding of human beings and their relations to one another, in their own development, and so on. But we'll see that in greater detail. I'm just trying to show that the materials that are being introduced here carry over in other contexts later on, and probably in contexts that for many of you will be much more interesting than the present. Finally, with regard to the classical anticipation, so we've got the differential equation. So finally, in this heuristic structure, in the upper blade is the anticipation of invariance. That once the laws and correlations and functions have been arrived at, they will be invariant. That is, they will always have the same intelligibility and meaning, and always use the same symbolic representation, no matter what the place or time. So that's the notion, the anticipation of invariance. A physicist in Canada can be on the internet with a physicist in China, and all they're doing is exchanging mathematical formulae, and they both know what they're talking about because it's invariant with respect to no matter what the place or time of the discovery. Okay? The anticipation is that there will be this invariance. They will always have the same intelligibility and meaning, and always the same symbolic representation once the law has been arrived at. This has caused some difficulty for physics, because physics regards motions, and so particular origins and orientations of reference frames, and there is a problem how to keep changes in reference frames from changing the statement of a principle or law. And I think Lonergan would probably use that question as his way of trying to explain what relativity is all about. I am not equipped to say a lot about this, and I have to just admit my lack of it. And if anybody wants to fill in here, you're most welcome to do so. But physicists have to express their principles and laws in equations that remain invariant under transformations of reference frames. There can be no change in the form of the law. That's the demand that they put upon themselves. This presupposes that physical principles and laws are the same for all observers, not because physical objects look the same for all observers. They don't. You're looking at them from a different distance, you've got different capacities of sight, and so on and so on. They don't look the same to everybody. But rather because physical principles and laws are simply and completely outside the range of seeing, hearing, touching, feeling, and all other acts of observing. They're a matter of understanding. They're not a matter of sensing. It's not what anything looks like. It's what it is and how you express that in a mathematical formula. It is, for example, not the appearance of colors, but the general explanation in terms of wavelengths of light. That's exactly the same, no matter what may be the state of the observer's eyes, the lighting by which they see, the speed with which they may happen to be in relative motion. Okay, and then he goes on to do more, which I'm not going to go into here, but unless there are questions, I'm going to pause here for a moment. We're at 3 o'clock anyway, so we can take a break. The general, this is what represents the dynamic aspect in classical science. What we'll see next are the limitations of this and the need for another heuristic structure if you're going to have a more complete picture. But we'll pause for a moment. First of all, take any questions that you might want to ask before a break, and we'll take a 10 minutes break. By the way, I'm going to ask your indulgence to allow me to leave at 4:05 today because there's a meeting of the theology department at the Toronto School of Theology, and I have to get over there, and I'm not the swiftest walker in the world, so if we allow that to happen, that would be very nice of you. So any questions that anybody wants to raise here? Yes, John?
Is wave-particle duality in quantum physics an example of a necessity of revising heuristic anticipation?
I think so, and I think for Lonergan it also means that there's a lot more work that needs to be done yet unless, since Insight, unless there has been some kind of a reconciliation of those two positions, but I'm not aware of that.
But all it takes is one instance of the unpredictability of a particle to force us to question the current heuristic anticipation.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
Certainly, anything that would, in a process of experimentation that would not satisfy what we've got right now, then it means that there's something's got to be revised. There's a need to go back to the drawing board. John?
I just often wonder about similars. Are similarly understood.
Right.
And if our brain is wired that way, and how that might relate to stereotyping.
In human relationships.
Yeah, it would seem like.
I think those are two really, my suspicion is those are distinct issues. In the sciences, that I think stereotypes are learned behavior, and I think that the similarities of things in their relations to one another are similarly understood is something that we're not going to question, you know. But when you're talking about stereotypes, first of all, you are talking about things in their relations to us. You're talking about gender, color, race, visible minority signs, and so on. So those are things in their relations to us, and we can form stereotypes. But were you there? You were at the Lonergan workshop this summer, and Sean Copeland gave that magnificent presentation on Martin Luther King and racism, and response to, because I asked her about how organic racism can become. I mean, and I wasn't saying that we're wired to be racist. I wasn't saying that at all. And I don't think she understood me to be saying that. But she said racism is learned behavior. She's convinced of that. But that it can go so deep into us that it does become organic, and the response becomes organic. But she was convinced that it's learned behavior. It's not something that's wired into us. And I think she's right. I hope she's right. I think she is.
I think on that point, Robert Coles would back you up in that statement. Is he fascinating how he deals with young children? And when you listen to their stories, how there comes a level, certainly in the one book that he did, is you go below what the parents and what the school has said, and you come to really what the child themselves from somewhere come up with. And it's just like, wow, the experience. Because it's not, I'll use the word polluted, by the home, by the school, the community, etc.
And you also find children who grow up in homes where there can be racial prejudice, but they are constantly questioning it. Or that, you know, from early on, they form a friendship at 5 years old with someone who is of this race or of this religion that their parents are constantly criticizing, and that, you know. It breaks down at that point. They might have to be quiet about it for a while.
My daughter has tried that as a teacher, as an elementary school teacher. And one of the discoveries that she had was when the one child described the other child, it wasn't like we would say by color, by physical, it was a description that was totally different. And you would never know then when you saw the child that the child actually had a different skin color. You know, and that kind of startled her, that there was something deep there that was, let's say the innocence was there.
John, your question is a good one. I mean, I think we are, use the term wiring or whatever you want. I mean, what's his name? Chomsky's going to talk about wiring, being wired for language. And he will say that despite the vast differences of language, that there are universal structures, you know. And this is a man who is not by any means a conservative, who's saying this, that there's a universality, a linguistic readiness, you know. And Lonergan will claim the same universality for the structures of coming to know, and he's beginning to unfold some of those. He's not by any means claiming that he's unfolded all of them. There's a great similarity between the two. But I think we have to be careful about how far we're going to push that, what we're wired to, because, and with regard to your question there, I would say right away that one of these similars are similarly understood as a heuristic for understanding, for knowing, and particularly for scientific knowing and explanatory knowing. And the other, I would
imagine stereotyping is an unreasonable judgment.
Oh, it is. I don't think there's any question.
It's a judgment based
on if it's your own judgment, but it can also be something that you've learned that has just been passed on to you in a culturally biased tradition. We've never questioned it. So. Okay, let's break until 3:15.